Hello, Foreign Entanglements viewers. My name is Dr. Robert Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. With me today is Jason Sorens. Jason, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of political science at the University of Buffalo, and I also blog at Phileas, phileasblog.com.
Right, and I recommend, and there'll be a link, I recommend that people take a look. It is a... the way I would think about it, it is a very diverse and multifaceted libertarian vision of political theory and public policy, right? I mean, it's not one issue. There's a whole variety of issues, but obviously that takes a distinctly libertarian understanding of the world and then applies that understanding to a whole set of different issues. Do you think that's a correct characterization of
Right, we're all classical liberals or libertarians, mm-hmm. but there are a couple things that distinguish us. Most of us are political scientists rather than philosophers or economists, which tend to be, most libertarian academics tend to cluster in those two disciplines. And in addition, we have a bit more of a... I would say we tend to see libertarianism not as a complete moral order, so to speak, and so we tend to have fairly diverse views about other values that society ought to promote. So, for instance, I have some environmentalist stuff that I periodically put up there, and Grover Cleveland's more of a virtue libertarian. So we're not these sort of thin libertarians who think that all you need to do is leave people alone, and that's that.
Right. Well, appropriately enough, today's conversation, we are not going to talk about the debate that happened last night because, frankly, both of us find it dreadfully uninteresting, such debates. But we are going to talk about some of the implications of a libertarian or of libertarian approaches to foreign policy, which is, I think, the fairest way to phrase it. And we're going to talk about applications of those approaches to foreign policy to certain particular issues. I want to start out, and the reason this subject is interesting in the last couple of weeks, and I think there's already been a blogging hits between Michael Cohen and Connor Friedersdorf, is that Connor, who was arguing from one of the libertarian perspectives, wrote an essay which was really effectively what he was trying to do was convince liberals and left liberals that voting for the Obama administration is essentially voting for President Obama is inappropriate given their liberal commitments, right? And this is particularly the case with regards to his disappointment and the disappointment of many liberals with the civil liberties record of the Obama administration, but also with the foreign policy, the essential, effectively the war and security policy aspects. And he talked about drone strikes in particular quite a bit. So I guess I'm curious your thoughts both on the essay itself, but also in sort of the larger theoretical issues that it evokes, behind a libertarian worldview, a libertarian view of foreign policy.
Yeah, so Friedersdorf belongs to a particular camp of libertarian foreign policy thought, which is, you might call it the moralistic camp, and I would place myself more in that camp myself. There are two other camps, a realist camp, and then more of a kind of almost neoconservative or Randian camp. So the moralistic camp tends to view foreign policy in terms of natural rights and the moral obligations of governments to respect the freedoms and lives of people. And so they would critique, as Friedersdorf does, governments that kill innocents or that torture or violate civil liberties, things like that. There's also, I think, a slightly different camp, although they're often allied in terms of practical policy implications, a more realist camp that would tend to say rather that that we can't moralize interactions among states, that in the international anarchic order, states can and should be concerned primarily with their own security interests. And so as a practical policy matter, realists and moralists both tend to be relatively non-interventionists. They both joined hands in opposing the Iraq War and things like that. But there's nevertheless a real fundamental philosophical difference between the two in that realists are less likely to resort to moral arguments. They'll simply say that, that the U.S. is not pursuing its foreign policy and permanent security interests rationally when it goes and tries to spread democracy or nation building or things like that.
And so this might be similar. This might be similar to, and I don't want to sort of characterize him in his greater worldview as libertarian, but this sounds a lot like the view that Stephen Wall tends to have, and he tends to promote on his blog. I mean, would that be accurate?
That's right, and we see a lot of that type of reasoning also coming out of think tanks like the Cato Institute. It tends to be more realist, national interest type of argumentation, whereas someone like Ron Paul, for instance, who wants to apply the golden rule to foreign policy and got booed in a Republican presidential debate for that, is much more in the moralist camp. So they come up with similar policy implications, but from different starting points.
Now, who are some examples of the people who would be in the third camp, what you characterize as sort of the Randian neocon libertarian camp? I mean, people who are sort of fall clearly within a libertarian worldview, but also have I hate the word hawkish, but for lack of a better word, a hawkish point of view on foreign policy.
Right, so Rand herself had this view that an oppressive government is not a legitimate government, and any other government may legitimately invade it and try to liberate its citizens. And so modern-day Randians, especially those of the more orthodox or maybe fundamentalist school associated with the Ayn Rand Institute, these fellows have definitely been more aggressive in terms of their foreign policy views and even advocating preemptive strikes against Iran and things like that. So they're domestically libertarian, and in a sense they are foreign libertarians as well, but they think that libertarianism should be imposed by the U.S. military if necessary.
So tacking back to the first group we talked about, the moralistic group, we'll work through some of my feelings about the essay, but I thought that Connor, in not only this essay but also in some other essays, was a bit sloppy with regards to conflating the moral good, the constitutional order, and international law, and you know, to the extent that he was willing to often imply, if not sort of outright say, that the three were essentially co-equal, right? That things like drone strikes and strikes against Al-Awlaki and so forth, or strikes against Al-Awlaki in particular, that these things were condemned under international law, that these things were probably unconstitutional, and that they were in any case immoral.
Right.
I mean, it seems to me that it's fairly easy to be on board with one of those and not with the other two, in a way that Connor didn't really seem to take into account. But, you know, and you know, part of this would be the argument, and I think the international law people who tend to back the administration's point of view on drone strikes, they tend to have a pretty good case regarding both the applicability of international law to drone campaigns, and perhaps a less compelling case, but still at least a case with regards to the specific targeting of American citizens. And when I say a pretty good case, I mean in international law, that's all we can really say, right? I mean, all we can really evaluate is whether somebody has a really good case, right? There's no single definitive adjudicator with regards to international law. So bringing this back to the moralistic perspective, for someone like yourself, are the constitutional order and international law relevant for how you approach a question like a drone strike. So, I mean, does it matter to you what, how international law can be interpreted in a particular way, or how the constitutional order can be interpreted in a particular way with regards to these foreign policy actions?
Yeah. I think for a lot of libertarians, those considerations would not be irrelevant. I mean, you certainly will get some libertarians who say all states are illegitimate, therefore, you know, law itself has no moral import. But a lot of other libertarians will say even if governments are, you know, not fully legitimate, they don't enjoy a robust consent of the governed in a particular way. A lot of them will nevertheless say that, that law, including international law, has value in that it establishes reliance interests and you know, kind of stable set of expectations that that people can take into account when making decisions, and that therefore deviations from those expectations need to be justified. But I think most libertarians would say, if, when it comes right down to it, if respecting the law requires doing something immoral, morality would trump law. And I'm sort of interested in how progressives would also respond to that. I mean, obviously not a not a unified camp either, I'm sure, on these questions. But you know, I agree that Friedersdorf's essay was definitely it got its punch, I think, from the moral arguments more so than the legal arguments. And I wonder how that how well that plays among progressives.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, you know, obviously we're talking about it, so obviously I've thought about it. I mean, my sense from reading, and what makes sort of this conversation between you and me interesting too, is that I tend to be a more statist progressive. Connor called on progressives to certainly he appreciated that progressives were going to make a value trade-off here, right? That's something they didn't like and something they did like. And part of the problem from my progressive point of view was that it's very easy for Connor to make this call because Connor was not making a value trade-off. And it's very easy to ask that others make value trade-offs when you yourself don't value the other thing, the things that are right. trading off. You know, my without and I am not willing, I think for good reasons, to endorse the wisdom of the drone campaign in Pakistan. The drone campaign in Somalia and in Yemen. I think that probably there is, as I suggested, the Sounder case with regards to legality than many people are willing to allow. With again caveats with regards to Al-Awlaki. In terms of trade-offs, and this. Became very interesting because Connor, of course, and I, you know, I follow Twitter, and I don't know how much of a Twitter guy I was, but he was having debates with Jamal Bowie, and he was having debates with Brad DeLong on these questions, and he would pose a dilemma, right? And he would suggest, well, here's a deal breaker, right? And so if Barack Obama came out and said some number of, you know, really atrocious things about Latinos, that evinced sort of a deep-seated bigotry against Latinos, would you still vote for him, given that you support a variety of his other positions, or would you consider this a deal breaker, and would you refuse to grant him your vote? And it was very interesting to me that he phrased it in that way, because he did not phrase it, Barack Obama displayed a great deal of bigotry against Latinos, and then Mitt Romney called him out on it, right? And in terms of the drone campaign, and I think in terms of a lot of different state questions more generally, sort of relationship of individual state questions more generally, you know, from my point of view, there's actually, it's not a particularly complicated issue. President Romney, if he becomes President Romney, is likely to continue a drone campaign. There is potentially good evidence. You know, it's always hard to say. You don't know how somebody's going to actually, you know how the environment's going to change or anything along those lines. But you know, it's entirely possible that he'll escalate a drone campaign or a variety of other foreign policy actions that will result in the deaths of innocent children in foreign countries. Without claiming any absolute knowledge of the future, I would evaluate at this point that he's probably more likely to lead to these kinds of campaigns than Obama.
Sure.
And so the question of how much I approve or disapprove of the drone campaign in context of a Romney-Obama election seems to be almost beside the point. And I guess the second progressive way to think about it would be, and the next part is sort of, I'm kind of wondering how appealing slash appalling you'll find this logic. The modern state is a machine for butchery, right? I mean, the modern state, it emerges as a killing machine because it's and it becomes successful because it's an extremely effective killing machine. It's a killing machine internally and externally. It, as a killing machine, has had some of its rough edges smoothed down to an extent, both on the external side and the internal side. But whenever you decide to give anyone the keys to the modern nation state, you need to have the appreciation that butchery and bloodshed is going to ensue. And this, it doesn't, in that sense, matter who's going to be president. Your hands, to the extent you take responsibility for putting someone in office by giving them your vote, your hands are inevitably going to be drenched in blood. And so then it simply becomes a question of how much blood and whose blood they will be drenched in. And then it leads to a set of entirely reasonable value trade-offs between... And this being completely understandable, how somebody would come down on the Romney side, right? But from my progressive point of view, again, this does not seem to me to be a very challenging value trade-off. So I'm curious what you think of that.
Yeah, no, those are fair points. I think what Connor's asking for is consistency. If you're going to say that about drone strikes, you should also say it. You know, if you were living in an era of segregation and you had two racist candidates, you're willing to vote for the lesser of two racists or something like that. And if you're willing to...
But that does actually characterize most of American history, though. Right?
Yeah, exactly. It does. Well, and here's another take I had on it. I think a possible response to his argument is that, you know, if Obama sat down and in private, had all these anti-Hispanic racial epithets or something like that, spoke these things, that would be an indication, I think, of a fundamental moral corruption, sort of a fundamentally corrupt character, which he's just a bad guy. I think people of goodwill can support the drone strikes. I think they're absolutely wrong, and wrong in a very important way. But it is a gray area. Not too many people would say, no, never use a drone under any circumstances. I mean, that's a little bit absurd. And I would argue that we've gone way too far in using these things and haven't been careful enough about the collateral damage. But you can be a person of goodwill and be somewhat, perhaps deluded or just honestly believe that this is a trade-off worth making and that this policy ought to be pursued. And so in that way, the drone strikes, even though in a sense of a greater humanitarian tragedy than racial epithets, may be less of a reason to think that that someone pursuing that policy is fundamentally evil than the racial epithets. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does make sense. I want to go back just a second here, because I think this is part of, we're going to get to sort of a broader analysis of libertarian foreign policy, but do you think, let me rephrase, what do you think of this analysis of the drone campaign, right? That the drone campaign, as we have seen it develop in Pakistan, which has spread from just a campaign targeted against a small number of people who are, with reasonably decent intelligence, acknowledged to be leadership members in Al-Qaeda or in organizations closely tied to Al-Qaeda, that once we accept the good of that, we then come to a situation where everyone wants to do it well. And so if we're doing it well, then we have more drones, we have more drones with higher capabilities, we have more drones on station all the time, which then leads to a situation in which mid-level commanders, high-level commanders, and so forth begin asking for greater freedom of action in terms of targeting, which then leads to a situation in which we are launching drone strikes in Pakistan against extremely low-level militants who have only the most tendentious connection to Al-Qaeda. But it's sort of a natural... The drone campaign, as it has expanded, especially in Pakistan, is sort of a natural statist progression for how the state deals with the problem.
Yeah.
It's completely understandable in terms of how bureaucracies seize turf and expand their writ and so forth.
Yeah, you make that technology of control cheap and easy, and it'll get overused. I mean, tasers would be another example, right? So people say, tasers are going to be great. You know, cops are going to use them as a good alternative to lethal force. Instead, they end up using tasers to take down grandmas and, you know, anyone who asks them a question or whatever, right? In the same way, drones, you know, in theory, a great technology we could use to actually target more and have less civilian damage, but because they are so cheap and easy and there's no risk to American lives that looks bad on TV, you know, they get overused. And it's just, in a sense, it's inevitable, but there's got to be some sort of reaction to that, some sort of policy that says, here's an acceptable level of use, and set some very bright lines about how we go about these things. Because, you know, as you say, the intelligence on a lot of these targets is not good. We're not...
Right.
They may be militants. They may not be. And so we're accepting greater and greater risk of civilian casualties. We know that there are civilian casualties. And so... if we think that that's a moral problem, then there needs to be some sort of policy to control their use and hedge it about tightly and focus it on real high value targets where there's a good certitude that these are real militants.
Just to ask about another one of my hobby horses. I am, as you may know, I am deeply skeptical of not just the utility of air power, but also the utility of the United States Air Force. Could you be convinced, or would you argue, or would you accept the argument, any of those three, that the problems associated with drones are a subset of the sort of broader problems associated with air power and with thinking through sort of an air-minded view of war, which sort of which I know, and I know that an air-minded view of war is actually something that, for example, Cato is quite comfortable with. Would you file drones, you know, under that same air power umbrella, that this is seen as a relatively cheap and antiseptic way of war, and, you know, consequently you have a variety of bureaucratic and political perversities that are spawned by that particular understanding?
Oh, absolutely. As a moralist rather than a realist, there are more problems with bombing, right? Especially the less discriminate it is. There is certainly a lot of a lot of collateral damage and civilian casualties and infrastructure destruction that was unnecessary in something like the Yugoslav bombing during the Kosovo crisis of the late 90s. But it's cheap and easy for politicians to do that. They don't want the Mogadishu style scenes. They don't want the guys coming home in body bags. But there's a good argument to be made that if this is a mission worth doing, go ahead and put your own forces on the line. Don't just have this push-button remote control war where the costs are all externalized onto the other, and you're not really paying any visible costs. There are hidden costs, to be sure, in terms of financial costs, but the visible costs are what galvanize the American public.
Right. I mean, I think I saw, I can't remember if it was a tweet or something else, but somebody made the argument that the marginal cost of a drone strike is too low. That it's very easy just to order one more drone strike against one more suspected militant, which makes the expansion of a drone war beyond its initial objectives almost inevitable, almost inevitable, especially in terms of a conflict, which, like the conflict between the United States and Al-Qaeda, remains sort of deeply, deeply ambiguous in terms of its eventual ending, right? So you can envision an almost endless expansion of that kind of war.
Yeah. Well, and there is you can make a realist case against the expanded drone war that this is going to generate blowback and problems like that, but it's going to be a little bit more tenuous and second order. Certainly as a libertarian who thinks that moral obligations don't stop at the border, I agree with Connor's assessment of the way this drone war is being conducted now.
Right. Yes, so step forward, even though this particular election is one that is between two gentlemen who seem to have little, or the likely winners are two gentlemen who seem to have little interest in a libertarian, in sort of libertarian visions of foreign policy. Now, there's a significant public intellectual aspect to what you do, and so obviously you feel that it's important to make a public case. I mean, do you see a future in which sort of your vision and your particular vision of foreign policy, which, I share bits of and don't share other bits of, but finding its way into a more secure place in American foreign policy discourse, right? Is there a roadmap from getting where we are now, where Conor Friedersdorf talks about Gary Johnson, who's going to get, 0.7% of the vote, to a future in which, candidate X at some point makes what is in essence, even if it's not identified, but what is in essence a moralistic libertarian argument about foreign policy in a debate like we had last night?
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest. At least a realist can say, look, we're not following our national interests, and there's going to be inherent tendency to correct over time on neoconservative excesses in Iraq and neoliberal and humanitarian interventionist excesses in Somalia or whatever tend to correct because the state has these permanent interests. I would like to believe that's true to an extent, simply because I think if realists are right that non-interventionism is in the U.S. national interest, that would, by happy coincidence, also tend to correspond more to the types of moral obligations I think the U.S. government has abroad. But, I'm not persuaded of that. I think there's a natural tendency everywhere, not just in the U.S., but for politicians to appeal to nationalism, patriotism, whatever you want to call it. And often that gets bound up with an aggressive foreign policy. One of the things I did read about the debates last night, even though I didn't watch them, was that undecided voters were thrilled when Romney said he wasn't going to cut the defense budget. Part of that is just maybe fiscal illusion. People don't think anything needs to be cut except the most general statement. Government spending needs to be cut, but not any particular part of it. That's part of what's going on, but then there's also just this, we're divorced from the cost of our actions, and most Americans don't really, think of foreign policy as a moral issue. I don't know how we get change there. It's going to have to be a very long run. Do you have ideas? Because obviously progressives have some of the same issues.
Right. I think that there is a... There has to be a space for the introduction of morality into a conversation of foreign policy, right? Because we have seen it, right? I mean, we've seen neoconservatives manage the language of morality and foreign policy very capably. And, you know, and this is, you know, certainly neoconservatives with regards to Iraq, Iran, and whatever else, they throw everything into the wall and see what sticks. But, you know, at the same time, for example, they mobilized quite carefully and quite reasonably what was effectively a moral concern over the effect of sanctions against Iraq. They turned that moral concern into an argument for invading Iraq, right? And what this tells me is that, on some level, moral considerations are relevant, and that moral considerations can be... the word I'm looking for is presented or framed
right.
in a way that are going to be compelling to a sufficient subset of Americans to make them politically relevant. Now,
I guess the problem for libertarians is that Republicans, with whom libertarians have tended to be more often allied, the Republican base is very much against that, against that kind of moralization, except to the extent that it's moralizing what other countries do and not what we do.
Right. But, you know, things change. And so, I mean, I think there have been times in American history where, and this would, you know, largely be pre-Second World War, which we, you know, it's an era of foreign policy that we shouldn't either misunderstand or excessively laud. But there were during those times, I think, moralistic anti-intervention arguments that were seen as compelling. You know, sort of moralistic anti-militaristic or anti-military arguments that were seen as compelling. Right, Herbert Hoover boasting that the United States had the smallest army of any great power. Right, which is inconceivable in the modern political context, but perhaps should be. And so it's happened before, and as we know from Battlestar Galactica, anything that's happened before can happen again. I mean, if you wouldn't mind if we sort of shift gears a little bit, because I'm very interested in, and since I have you here, very interested in the international implications of conceiving of how we conceive of the relationship between the individual and the state. And you mentioned patriotism and nationalism and so forth. And I know you've done some work on secessionism before, on why regions secede. The most recent secessionist discussion we have, separatist discussions that we've been seeing in the Western world, have come in Spain, where you obviously have a serious economic crisis in Spain. You have a state that has never quite been as complete as it's looked from the outside. But you appear to be having some regions where you're finding significant separatist sentiment. And this isn't the only part in sort of straightforward Western countries that we've seen this kind of sentiment. You see the same thing in Belgium. You see the same thing in the United Kingdom with regards to Scotland and to a lesser extent Wales. And, of course, Northern Ireland. You see the same thing in Canada with regards to Quebec. With your political science hat on, you know, what's going on with this? Is this nothing? Is this interesting? Is this a new development? Is this simply an artifact of really bad economic times? And with your libertarian hat on, what does it mean when people who are members of a more or less free, liberal democratic state like the United Kingdom or Canada, spend their time and treasure, and hopefully not blood, but conceivably blood, in order to try to win independence to form another state with almost exactly the same sort of governmental structure, but just with another name and another national identity. So,
right.
Go.
Yeah, well, I mean, the way to think about these secession movements is that they're all based around some kind of identity, but a separate subnational identity alone doesn't cause a secessionist movement. So in Belgium, for instance, the Flemings are interested in independence, but the Walloons are not. In Canada, the Québécois, French Quebecers, want to secede, or some of them do, but indigenous nations generally do not and are happy with Canada. In France, Corsica causes lots of problems, but Brittany and Alsace do not. So there are lots of examples of this, and what it comes down to is that when people think of themselves as belonging to a particular group, a particular political identity, they're interested in the future of that identity, of that group of people. And so they'll start to visualize politics in terms of how it affects the group. So in the U.S., an American national identity is fairly universal, and so Americans tend to think of politics in terms of, at least in terms of foreign affairs, they tend to think in terms of, American national interests and what's good for Americans. But imagine if you had a minority group within the U.S. that was nationalistic and saw its own political identity as fundamental, and the American identity as something sort of grafted onto that, they would tend to think of their own national interests as coming first. So what you get when national interests seem to conflict with the interests of the state, so Scottish interests conflicting with British interests, or Catalan interests conflicting with Spanish interests, then people who have those identities tend to associate more with a local interest and will support independence if necessary to guarantee those interests. And the reason why many Catalans are now interested in independence from Spain is not that they hate Spain so much, but that they are worried about the future for Catalonia, for their region, for their nation as they conceive it. As long as Spain can ensure a good future for Catalonia, you don't get strong nationalism because people are fine staying in Spain. They view the Spanish statehood and the Catalan identity as perfectly compatible. But it's when Catalan interests seem to be threatened in the future by remaining within Spain that you get a stronger secession movement. The point of secession is not to have a dramatically different government, but just to ensure a government that can better protect Catalan interests. And in Spain, the real problem there is the fiscal situation, in which richer regions like Catalonia are heavily subsidizing the rest of Spain, and that tends to bite harder during fiscal hard times, during a debt crisis. And so Catalans, it's not that they, want an illiberal government or, they want to expel Spanish speakers or anything like that. There's no hardcore nationalism. There's no radical ideology driving this. It's just our interests will be better secured if we're independent. And so you're unlikely in that kind of situation to see a violent movement for independence, because it's not as if our very survival as a people is threatened. We're not under threat of genocide or ethnic cleansing or anything, but you will see an attempt to push the envelope through the political process and try to get as much autonomy as possible. Independence is a very unlikely outcome to this, but more autonomy is quite conceivable, and in fact, you've seen a lot of European countries decentralize as a response to secessionism. Spain itself, when it became democratic, Italy more recently, Belgium quite recently. So these movements retain interest even when their objective of independence seems unlikely, simply because they are reshaping the territorial structure of the states they inhabit.
Now, do you think the European Union, sort of the overarching structure of the European Union, reduces the stakes in these kinds of fights, right, to the extent where, even if Catalonia were to secede, or northern Italy, or parts of Belgium and so forth, that the greater portion of the economic and political structure under which people live would be utterly unchanged? because the European Union fulfills so much of the major state function, and so that consequently national governments are just less likely to react extremely negatively to these kinds of, I mean, I'm sort of putting together a story here,
yeah.
but are less likely to react with a great deal of hostility to these kinds of movements.
Yeah, I mean, so the argument that is more commonly expressed is slightly different, which is that economic integration lowers the economic costs of independence for small countries. So an independent Catalonia or an independent Scotland back in the 1800s would have had to play power politics, you know, balance of power politics in Europe, and it would have been an insecure environment, and they would have faced lots of trade barriers. The European Union, that potentially all changes, assuming Catalonia gets admitted to the European Union, Scotland gets admitted after they become independent. The costs are very low, and there's evidence for this in polling. So you ask people in Scotland, do you favor independence in Europe? And you'll get a much higher percentage of people saying yes than if you just ask them if they favor independence. So there's something to be said there, although this is a topic that political scientists are continuing to debate, and the way I see it, there's not actually sufficient evidence yet to say that European integration has actually caused more secessionism or caused more decentralization or things like that. So there's a nice just-so story there, but the evidence is more complex.
So taking off your political science hat and looking at it through your more just straightforwardly political hat, I mean, do you find these kinds of movements alarming? Do you find these kinds of, like the continuing relevance of these kinds of identities, which then produce almost inevitably nationalistic, patriotic feelings and commitments and so forth, does your libertarian hat find this kind of thing alarming?
Yeah, well, a yes and no. So for someone who believes in a robust view of individual rights, certainly nationalism sounds collectivist, and it sounds like a potential threat to individual rights. So there's sort of a prima facie skepticism toward nationalism. However, it can be a potentially useful evil within certain bounds, or a useful falsehood, perhaps. If a lot of libertarians, and I tend to agree with them, think that decentralization is a good thing, that having a state closer to the people is a good thing, and greater mobility across borders, a good thing, more competition among governments. So if minority nationalist movements can help push governments to decentralize territorially, then they might be useful in that respect. And conversely, I think a lot of progressives who are naturally skeptical of nationalism as well, because they see this as a kind of barrier to universal human rights and egalitarianism. A lot of them, though, have argued that, well, you know what, it's good to have a homogeneous state, because then people feel more willing to undertake duties of social justice and things like that.
Right.
So in a Norway or a Sweden, a fairly small homogeneous state, you're going to have a much more generous welfare state. And that would be a sort of a progressive argument, in a sense, for actual secession, actually breaking up extremely heterogeneous states where people are squabbling all the time over the political spoils and aren't able to get a generous safety net as a result. Maybe you get something closer to a progressive vision of justice with smaller,
right,
more homogeneous countries.
Although, I mean, and I think Matthew Iglesias has made this point several times, that in the context of the European Union, the people of Germany are far less willing to subsidize the people of Greece than the people of New York are willing to subsidize the people of Mississippi. Perhaps it's because the distinctions are just too profound, but it also then suggests that schemes for redistribution among states rather than just inside states would be rendered even more difficult, even in a sort of a supranational context like the European Union. So I guess it cuts both ways.
Yeah, my view is that the European Union is largely actually a constraining force on member governments. That, you are getting tax competition across borders. And Ireland benefited from this greatly in the 80s and 90s, cutting business taxes and things like that and attracting capital. And on the other hand, the level of redistribution really among member states is quite low, despite all the talk about equalization payments, and they try to make it very visible. But by and large, I think progressives who are worried about market constraints on state capabilities should be more concerned about the European Union than they are, and I think libertarian market-oriented sorts should be a little bit maybe more optimistic about the European Union than they are. I don't. Euroscepticism seems to correlate the other way.
Right,
right-wingers tend to be more Eurosceptic and left-wingers more Euro-enthusiastic, but if economics is the deciding criterion, it seems to me it should go the other way.
Right. That's interesting. To take it out of a, I think both a succession question, but I want to continue to hold on to this libertarian thread. Let's talk a little bit about what happened in Georgia last week and sort of its relationship to what happened in Georgia 4 years ago with regards to the secessionist movements in Russia, or the Georgian secessionist movements that are now kind of part of Russia. And to American foreign policy, right? Certainly in 2008, there were a number of voices that, even if they, I don't know if it would be best to associate with sort of the Randian element of mm-hmm. the libertarian wing, but certainly there were very vocal arguments that the United States was to some degree responsible or obligated to support Georgia and Georgian President Saakashvili in its conflict with Russia, and in particular the effort to regain full legal and de facto control over the two secessionist regions, right? Especially South Ossetia, mm-hmm. but presumably Abkhazia. At the time, this struck me as extremely problematic for a variety of reasons. On the one part, whatever you were going to say about South Ossetia, it seemed fairly obvious to me that the South Ossetians did not want to be part of Georgia.
Right.
And wanting to be part of Russia is never something I consider sensible, but the people on the ground at least seem to think that that was a good idea. And so who are we to dictate to them? And there also, to my mind, seemed to me an almost willful blindness of problems with the Saakashvili regime.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now there's been a political change in Georgia. Mm-hmm. So, I guess I'll just sort of let you go and go ahead and give your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I agree with your judgments. It's how can libertarians support crushing secessionist movements by force of arms? I don't get it. Maybe if they were going to obscenely repress the minorities within their own borders, even more so than Georgia would have been oppressing their minorities, maybe then you can make the case for doing it. I think you can make a strong libertarian case for crushing the Confederate States of America, for instance, but that's not what we're talking about here. I think there seems to be a kind of mentality that, well, they're pro-Western, so we should support them. If they're pro-us, we should be pro-them. But pro-Western doesn't necessarily mean liberal. As we saw, Saakashvili ended up being a strong Georgian nationalist, and he ended up being pretty illiberal on civil liberties. And one of the issues this election turned on was, of course, those pretty horrific prison abuse videos that were coming out, which is just part of the sorts of things you get when you have a total crackdown on crime. There are going to be excesses like that. And we've seen what happened. So, I don't think the U.S. had a particular dog in that fight. And from a realist point of view, it's just by ring-fencing Russia like this, you're just making them feel more threatened. right? We're going to expand NATO to Russia's doorstep on every side. You know, that's you're just asking for hostility as a kind of consequence of that. So, you know, I don't know what you think about that, but it just doesn't seem to make sense on just plain old international security grounds to be so buddy buddy with countries like Georgia. And I mentioned Ukraine, which also is kind of backslidden since its own Orange Revolution and the sort of U.S. overtures at bringing Ukraine into NATO, which of course would just even more, you know, point a dagger at the heart of Russia.
Right. I mean, I would say, and on this, I think that we'd probably be in pretty close agreement that there needs to be a fuller understanding of the ways in which national security paranoia, not just in the United States, but everywhere else, breeds civil liberties abuses. And that, of course, amping up the paranoia in foreign countries is not a one-to-one relationship, but is extraordinarily likely to then breed abuses of civil liberties, of civil liberties above and beyond what would otherwise happen if sort of relatively cordial relations were maintained. And I think that there are trade-offs in that, right? And, you know, and Russia's a good example. I mean, you know, we have some NGOs that work in close collaboration with our intelligence agencies, but we also have a number of NGOs who seem genuinely dedicated to the protection of civil liberties in Russia that at the same time produce Russian paranoia. And so, you know, the fact that the Russians are going to be paranoid and that they're going to violate civil liberties is not completely dispositive of any particular policy. But it certainly has to be taken seriously when we're thinking about whatever we're thinking about.
Rob, unfortunately, I've got a student at my door, so I have to.
All right. Well, Connor, this has been. I am not going to promise that this is going to be one of the most popular blogging heads ever, but it's been one of the most interesting for me. So
I enjoyed it as well.
All right, Foreign Entanglements viewers, thank you so much, and we will see you again soon.
Thanks. Bye.